James Gorbick, great to have you back on the Jack Blood Show podcast. I guess this is the first podcast you're doing with us.
It is indeed, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'm raring to go.
Now, I didn't know, is this new that you were writing for the International Forecaster? That's Bob Chapman's newsletter, and RIP Bob.
Yeah, absolutely, RIP Bob. Well, I've been writing for about 15 months now, so it's not exactly new. But yes, it's definitely a huge set pair of shoes to fill, and obviously I can only do my humble part. But I've been writing the editorial there for over a year now.
Total meltdown coming by the end of the year. I believe that's usually what I read in the Forecaster.
Yeah, well, it's always on the brink of that, isn't it? Well, yes. I mean, there's a lot to say about that. But right now, what we're all waiting for is what the Federal Open Market Committee, aka the Federal Open Mouth Committee, is going to do next month with regards to the so-called tapering. And we already saw even the mention of the idea that they might cut back on the amount of money they're pumping into the system right now, $85 billion a month. The idea that they might cut back on that sent interest rates spiking from 1.5% to now punching 2.9% for the 10-year treasuries, which is, I think, the sign of things getting out of control. I mean, that's the real indicator we should be looking at in terms of the health of the economy, not the blown-up stock market. It's the 10-year treasuries, which they can't really fudge how much they're having to pay for their debt. And once that starts hitting, say, 1990 levels of 8%, that's kind of Armageddon, considering the half a quadrillion dollars of interest rate derivatives that are currently out there that haven't been soaked up. So that's a huge thing that's coming next month, and we'll have to see what develops as a result of that.
It was nice of Obama to play Santa Claus to Wall Street. He didn't do anything to pull back on the derivatives. And now we are seeing a massive real estate bubble growing again here. Obviously, the stock market bubble growing. A lot of people's retirement funds are tied up in things like this, James. I mean, you got to see the other shoe dropping at some point.
And that's not only true, that's only, I mean, partially part of the bubbles that have been blown. But in fact, we had a major, a high-ranking Bank of England official come out a couple of months ago to say that they have intentionally blown the biggest bond bubble in history, in the history of the planet. So to see that bubble unwinding is not going to be a pretty thing. And I do not revel in this. I mean, this is genuinely the type of information that can truly cause just untold devastation in people's lives, because even people who aren't invested in the markets and don't care what's happening in the greater economy, it will come back to you if and when this starts to fall apart. And that's why I keep my eye so closely on this, because again, this is, at the end of the day, it's about human suffering. And unfortunately for all of us who are tied into this fiat money creation system, the debt money that they have us enslaved to, when that goes, so go the average working person. So this is a huge thing, and I really hope people are keeping their eyes on this, because again, these bubbles have been being blown up for years now, and it's at the point where it's, I mean, I guess it would be comical if it wasn't so serious, but to have a half quadrillion dollars in interest rate derivatives floating around out there now, which is many, many times the size of the entire world economy, that's a pretty precarious situation. And to know that it's in the hands of these banksters who are only too happy to bring the system down if it means that they get to buy everything up at pennies on the dollar is kind of the scary part of it.
Order out of chaos. And that shouldn't surprise anybody that the powers that be, the bigger investors, the bigger hedge funds, the Rothschild banks, the Rockefeller banks, they don't lose money in these when these bubbles burst. They seem to get out just in time. I don't know. I mean, maybe they're clairvoyant. Maybe they have a crystal ball or something.
Well, the important thing to keep in mind is it's not about the dollar figure. It's about the relative value of the dollars that they have. If they're happy to take a big cut in the number of zeros on the end of their bank account if it means that they still have a greater proportion of control at the end of the day. And that's exactly what we saw during the Depression. The wealth wasn't really destroyed. It was just transferred to fewer hands. And that's what happens every time there's one of these shearing of the flock. And unfortunately, it looks like we're due for a massive shearing. And again, I'm not relishing this. And I certainly hope that I'm wrong. And I hope that they're able to expand the economy out from these bubbles. But I'm not holding my breath for that.
Good point. It's about the power more even than the money. But when you know it's coming and you can get yourself out and capitalize on it, even put, you know, have put options, even bet and hedge against the market, you can really do quite well for yourself. Not that they need more money. It's, as they said in Wall Street, a zero-sum game. It's just a way of keeping score. And at some point, you know, one elite's looking at the other elite and going, ha-ha, I made $1 trillion this year. You only made $500 billion. So, you know, there's that too. But we have to keep in mind that when we lose our capital, our investment into these bubbles, these are the guys that come in and buy low. So they sell at the right time, and then they come in and buy very low and then create the bubble all over again. It is such a Ponzi scheme. It is amazing. I think it was Henry Ford that said, if the American people knew how the financial institutions work, there'd be a revolution by morning.
On that very note, one of the figures that I think people should be keeping their eyes on is the Commitment of Traders reports that comes out each month that shows the positions of the banks with regards to the precious metals. And you'll notice in the last few months that all of the major commercial banks have gone have almost completely cleared out of their short positions on gold and are going long, whereas the large and small specs are all caught short because the gold market obviously plummeted earlier this year.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see the uptick in gold now, and I think there's I really think that there's huge bullish potential there. So I hope people will keep their eye on the Commitment of Traders report, because again, you're exactly right. They always seem to be on the right side of these bull markets when they start, and the public always seems to be on the wrong side, listening to the MSNBS and the other liars out there. So
exactly. Well, you're getting it from James Corbett, thecorbettreport.com. And this is a nice treat, James, because we hadn't planned to do any financial talk on the broadcast today. We've got a lot of topics to get to, but I'm glad that we were able to nail that down. And that's exactly what I said in 2012, that by the end of the year, we're going to see metals go up. And we're already seeing silver. It looks like it's really being held down by a gang of steroid-ridden wrestlers at this point, and they just can't keep the good silver down. It's needed too much for too many things. Too many people want it, and when the economy starts looking shaky, people go run to metals, and that is definitely something that we can expect. But then again, you know, people are scared of it, I think, largely because it's so manipulated. I want to ask you about this since we're on the topic. We were reporting at the end of the year there'd be a lot of changes in the government and the Obama administration, and including the change at the Federal Reserve. Here we are, and Bernanke is almost out. It looks like Janet Yellen was coming in, and she was sitting at the feet and learning from Alan Greenspan. She's an Alan Greenspan protege from the Board of Governors, and she's been sitting patiently under helicopter Ben Bernanke, who is Father Christmas. But all of a sudden, out of the blue, comes Larry Summers. And literally, Vegas is betting on Larry Summers. They know something maybe we don't. It's almost unbelievable to think that Larry Summers could get in that job, even though he does have a lot of experience with the Federal Reserve, but that he has so many enemies and so many people are against him. To think that Larry Summers could be the head of the Federal Reserve is something I really couldn't have predicted a few years back.
You're exactly right about that. I wouldn't have predicted that in a million years. And let's keep in mind, this is heck of a job, Larry, that Obama said on when he was on his way out. This is, I mean, it is absolutely ridiculous to think of this man in charge of the Federal Reserve, the very man who took away the safeguards that was preventing the derivatives tidal wave that that back in the Clinton administration was repealed. So this is, I mean, it is a bizarre turn of events, and I don't think, I mean, Yellen or Summers, I don't think either possibility is going to be a good one for the average working man or woman out there. But the idea of Larry Summers in particular is a bit scary, and the idea that he is now not only a serious contender, but perhaps the leading contender is one that should be worrying everyone.
No, I feel like we're getting punked is the whole thing here, and that people are really asleep at the wheel. How much, in your opinion, does the head of the Federal Reserve, how much power does he really have? Is he just a figurehead like cousin Barry Obama in the White House? And what about the illusion that the president actually picks who the head of the Federal Reserve is going to be?
He picks it from a list that's sent to him by the Federal Reserve. So it is, I mean, it's
the one with the big X next to it is the one they think maybe he should pick.
Yeah, probably. But you're exactly right. It is it's completely a puppet position in many ways. I mean, if Bernanke was truly going to go rogue and do something that that the other members of the Federal Reserve didn't want, I don't think he'd get away with it for very long. It's obviously a position that's well screened in advance, so I don't think anyone gets in there by accident. And I think the real power, in fact, has often been said to be located, in fact, the New York Federal Reserve, where we, for example, I mean, we get Treasury secretaries and the like coming from there all the time. And they always tend to be people who have a background with Goldman Sachs or some of the other big six banks. So it's a very tight-knit system. And the important thing for people to know is that the people sitting on the board of the Federal Reserve are the CEOs of the banks, who are the ones who end up getting the trillions upon trillions of dollars during the bailout situations. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in the wake of the 2008 Lehman Brothers collapse. And that's been well documented now. The very people who were voting on where that money should be, the bailout money should be going, were the very people sitting on the boards of the banks that received the money. So no surprise how that works.
I think, you know, they're going to close the credit. They've had this free, easy money going for so long, as you mentioned, about $85 billion a month going to the discount window, which, if you guys don't know what that is, it's almost an interest-free loan, although we get charged for the interest. We, the American people, we pay the interest on the loans that the banks get for free and then loan out with fractional reserve lending multiple times. But it looks to me as if the fix is in and that they're going to start tightening credit, and I guess that would be the collapse of the bubble we spoke of earlier. James Corbett is on the broadcast with us today. Corbett Report, that's with two T's. Just put it anyway into your search engine. It'll come right up. He's that popular. I saw you had Bill Still on, one of my favorite analysts, on the Jekyll Island conspiracy. I didn't get to hear it. That's your August 19th show here. What was the synopsis? What did he tell you?
Well, he's got a new documentary out just in time, I guess, for the 100th anniversary of the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, which is coming up this December. And the new documentary goes into some of the sort of history of the creation of the Federal Reserve and also the political climate that created that. Because it's important for us to understand here 100 years later, now that the banksters have been in control for that that past century, that they've completely eliminated any actual understanding of finance from the general public opinion. I mean, no one really thinks deeply about these issues anymore on a political scale, because we're taught to care more about abortion and gay rights and the like, because those are the safe political football issues. But 100 years ago, this was seen as the driving force, the center of what politics was really all about. And it was a huge issue. And in fact, ever since the founding of the United States and the first central bank of the United States, the second bank of the United States, and then the creation of the Federal Reserve, it was always an issue that was deeply and widely debated amongst the public. And that was, of course, no exception in the run-up to the Federal Reserve back in 1907. In fact, the Rockefellers and the Morgans decided to take out some of their competition, and they ended up sinking the Knickerbocker Trust, which started a sort of chain reaction, which caused a panic on the markets back in 1907. And as a result of that, as the order out of chaos, they decided to pitch the Federal Reserve. And of course, they originally pitched it as the Aldrich Act, but everyone knew who Aldrich was and what team he represented, so it didn't get any traction. So they went and rejiggered it and just basically renamed it the Federal Reserve Act. And apparently, with some judicious propaganda inserted in the right controlled publications, it was enough to convince the public that this was that they were going to get the bankers in control. This is what this was all about. When, of course, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, it was actually a plan that had been put together by those very bankers in a highly secretive meeting that they undertook back in 1910, I believe, at Jekyll Island, which is a rather secluded little island location off the coast of Georgia, I believe.
It's pretty close to me here. And in fact, we'll be making a trip there, I guess, over the next month or two. We also live in Sector 6 for the Federal Reserve of Atlanta, which controls a big chunk of the South. Okay, so that is really important, and I love that point that you made, that this was a huge centerpiece of politics 100 years ago, and you'd have to think that if there's one thing they wanted to do, that was to find a way to either dumb people down, get them so distracted or so preoccupied that they wouldn't think about it. They wouldn't know what the Federal Reserve even is and thinks maybe that it's federal and it has reserves, for instance, or even that it's just the United States Central Bank, if you get that far. We're finding out now that their power has increased so much over the last few decades, thanks to Greenspan's globalization plan and bailing out to entire countries, and the dollar being pegged as the global reserve currency, that they are in charge. They are the global central bank, not something they'd really want us to know about.
Well, it's all part and parcel. And in fact, one of the things I've been looking into recently, I haven't done any work on it lately on the podcast, but I'm planning to do so in the near future, is the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central bank of central banks and is still largely known to the general public. And even in the alternative media, I think there's not a lot of understanding of this institution, where it came from, how it was literally the vehicle through which the Nazis were able to continue international finance activities during the war. They were supported by the banksters the whole time. They could have shut that spigot off at any time, but instead you had people actually at the Bank for International Settlements during the war signing off on all their correspondence, Hail Hitler. I mean, it was so blatant what it was being used for, and unfortunately not a lot has changed, just as some of the names and characters have changed, but it's still being used as the engine for funding global conflict and for making sure that people who do not go along with the system will get basically removed from that system. And we've seen the way Iran has been targeted financially over the past couple of years and basically taken off the financial radar and removed from the SWIFT system and all of this. So there's an incredible amount of control through organizations like the BIS and its related sister organizations. And so I want to explore that a bit more in the future.
Well, sure. And I've done a lot of work on that with people like Joan Vian and others. I was talking to Andrew Goss about a year ago, and I'm not sure if you check out his work. I want to recommend him to people. He believes that, and I'm with him on this, that the Federal Reserve has now superseded the Bank of International Settlements and every other central bank in the world, and that they're calling all the shots right now. Now, I know there might not be a discernible difference between the two, but that seems to me to be a major power shift and something that I want to key and in on and look after. Because if we can make this correction to end the charter, to repeal the Federal Reserve, it will have worldwide implications. And maybe it might even be hard for a while, James. I don't expect any of this to be easy, but I like to be very clear on who the target is. This talk about who's running the world, not too helpful to me over the years. So I don't care about it for that reason, because I think we should be running our own communities and detaching ourselves from any centralized planning. But if we know who's pulling the strings, or at least what organization might be pulling the strings and how they have advanced over the last, you know, decade or so, I think it's important. So maybe we can go and revisit that debate at some point.
Well, I'm with you on that largely, and I agree that I think the important point for me isn't trying to attack the beast head on, because that's a surefire way to, I think, just lose a lot of people in that kind of battle, because they're very much prepared for that. But I think the point is to try to create the alternative systems that have nothing to do with the system they're trying to round us up into, so that they can create that order out of chaos.
Tragedy may be that of your daughter, or your son, or yours, or yours, or yours.
James Corbett with us, the CorbettReport.com. He does worldwide podcasts, and I saw that you were on Sky Satellites in Europe, reaching, what, about 1 million people? Because I'm about to go on that, too, here in a couple of weeks.
I have absolutely no idea what the numbers are on that, but I do get emails from people saying that they found me through Sky. So I'm just flattered and amazed to be part of that. So it's great to have that kind of outlet. And that's the incredible power of the alternative media. Yeah. I mean, it literally, this type of thing would have been unthinkable even a few years ago to people like myself. But now it's at your fingertips, and not just me, not just you, but anyone out there can take up a microphone and start doing this. I mean, I have no special training, so it's always mind-blowing to see how far my message is spreading.
Well, yeah, but you have freakish talent. I don't know if just anyone can do that. I've heard anyone trying to do it in the past, and I don't know. Well, I mean, the interesting thing about, you know, broadcasting on satellite to Europe, and a lot of people don't understand that because we're spoiled here, but there isn't a cable or coaxial infrastructure, a DSL line infrastructure like we have here. So a lot of the people can only get things through satellite, and I guess that makes things easy to shut off and control. But I'm happy to get in there. You know, one of the best things we did was get on Roku.com, where we have about 25 to 30,000 subscribers right now, and you put me next to any of the other people on there, the free news channels, and we are completely different and outside the box. So it gives people a pretty neat choice to have, and hopefully we're reaching our personal demographic, which are, you know, hardcore anarchist punk rockers. No, I'm just kidding. because I was just describing my friend James Corbett, who really, I mean, if you can see him at night at the club, it's really something to behold.
I'm more of a jazz fan, actually, but I'll go with that.
No, I know you like rock and roll, though, and I think that's cool. No, I mean, because I have to reach, I want to try to reach people that aren't already in the pie. I don't want to preach to the choir, so we're always trying to find new culture jamming to not only be a part of the culture, and we're seeing this in the music and in television and in movies. We're seeing a lot of our information being, you know, snuck through, and so, you know, I like to contribute to that. Let's radically shift gears here, and James Corbett again with us at CorbettReport.com. You had me on your show yesterday, and we talked about this, the Hastings autopsy. Right on cue, man. People want to know what happened. They are not leaving this case alone. Some reporters, as we talked about yesterday, getting hacked and punished for even discussing that there could be some kind of a wider conspiracy here. Yet we've got Richard Clark, our former cyber czar, saying that he thought Hastings' car showed every sign of hacking. We'd posted on our website the Forbes team with computer hackers sitting in the backseat with a laptop controlling the car's steering wheel, its gas pedal, just about everything that can be done to a car. They were able to do very simply with a little laptop. So this is all possible. And here we get the autopsy report today, the one we thought we weren't going to get. And lo and behold, traces of meth were found in his body, I believe also alcohol and marijuana, found in reporter Michael Hastings' body leading up to his fatal crash.
Indeed, how convenient for this to be part of the character assassination that always follows these types of real assassinations. There's a couple of important things to take away from this. First of all is that the coroner report stresses that neither the marijuana nor the amphetamine had anything to do with the crash itself. They don't believe it played any role. What they found is trace amounts that had been consumed at least hours before the crash. So it was not a factor in the crash itself, according to the coroner report itself. So really, this information is making the headlines and, meth found in Hastings' system, but it's not actually a contributing factor to the crash. The other important thing is that it's being identified in all the headlines as methamphetamine, but as far as my understanding is, they can't distinguish between methamphetamine and other types of amphetamine that could be derived from other sources. And
cold medicine, for instance, maybe.
Exactly. All sorts of medicines have amphetamines of different sorts. There's all sorts of different places this could be deriving from. So everyone's saying, oh, he was on meth. Clearly, this is what was basically happening. But it's not so clear at all. The other interesting part about this report is that it includes some more information from the LAPD investigation. And supposedly, this includes the fact that a couple of Hastings' brothers had arrived in LA quite close in time to the actual crash, who were apparently concerned about him relapsing because he had had substance abuse problems in the past. And so they were apparently there to check up on him because they thought he was relapsing. And one of the brothers apparently found him at the place that he was renting, passed out at around 12:30 or 1 a.m. So he left him there, and then a few hours later, for some unknown reason, he's out on the streets speeding around in an exploding car. So this is just another detail that's been inserted into this mix. And again, take it for what it's worth, coming from the LAPD. But of course, it's being unquestioningly reported by the mouthpiece media, and we're supposed to take this as basically case closed.
Well, that's some pretty good meth to knock an engine 100 feet away from the car. We're talking about the entire engine, folks, in one of the safest cars in the world, a Mercedes. Don't you wish we had some more funds available to us so we can do some crash test experiments with the new Mercedes to see what would happen?
Well, Mercedes does its own crash tests, and as far as I know, they've never reported on any of them resulting in fireballs that literally light up the night sky like a bomb. I mean, if people have seen the surveillance footage of this, I mean, it's just absolutely incredible, the size of the explosion. So, this is absolutely not anything that would ever happen in any conceivable crash test that Mercedes has ever done or reported on. And yet Mercedes isn't commenting on the case because they haven't been asked to. So they're and hoping that none of this will backfire on them. And it won't, because the media won't play up that angle.
They've been asked, James. I believe they've been asked multiple times by any number of reporters and even amateur reporters. And they're not commenting. Look, they have their own distribution cartel to think about here. And let's be frank, the giant car companies aren't owned generally by very nice, caring people. So they care more about their company and their bottom line and going along to get along than they do generally the public safety of the people. In fact, a lot of times, as we'll get to here at Fukushima in a minute, they'll cut corners and know that their lawyers can take care of any settlements and damage. It's just cheaper than doing things the right way. But Mercedes-Benzes have been notoriously known for being extremely safe. And that's why the anomalies, the physical anomalies of that crash are pretty glaring. Hastings family members had a surprising reaction when contacted by who, what, why. You know, our friend Russ Baker over there. He was calling the coroner's report irresponsible, the family member. He says, quote, "I can honestly say with absolute certainty he wasn't doing meth," the family member said, requesting anonymity. Probably after this happened to his family member, didn't want to come out in the open. I'm sure they're a little nervous. Methamphetamine, of course, as you said, can be nasal spray, Sudafed, one of those upper drinks at the gas station, prescription amphetamines, etc. I guess what they're trying to say here with Hastings is that he had been sober for a number of years and that he somehow relapsed. Didn't cause the crash, but it could have led to some of the circumstances. I think more importantly, they want to impugn his character so that people want to fall off and peel off and not be associated with this case anymore. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds exactly right, unfortunately. And I think the interesting part of that report, once again, is the request for anonymity from the family member, because why on earth would the family member not go completely out on in public on the record to say that this is complete BS? Why would they do it through an anonymous source to a relatively small alternative media outlet? It's because, again, obviously the family either has been threatened directly or can read the writing on the wall and know that if they stick their head up on this, it's going to have serious implications for them. So I think that's the important part of this. Even the family is afraid to speak out against this in public.
Yeah, I think this is a related case. We talked about this on your podcast yesterday. James Corbett with us, the Corbett Report. Remember Michael Hastings, especially with the new developments, how you can hack into implanted medical devices. As we know, Barnaby Jack was on his way to the Giant Hackers Convention to demonstrate this live for the participants. He could make cash machines spit out money. Wouldn't we all love to do that? And he believed that he could demonstrate that he can get through an implantable medical device. Remember, they tried to put that into Obamacare, and it was taken out eventually. But a lot of people have these now, and it can kill you. And what he was going to demonstrate was that he could slow down your heart rate or your pacemaker or speed it up, which would cause you to potentially have a heart attack. It's pretty scary thinking that people are walking around with these ticking time bombs. Barnaby Jack, though, didn't make it to the demonstration. He died. I have a one-minute clip here, James. Here it is.
Before he was to give a major presentation on this danger. ABC's Lindsay Davis is here with all of that. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning, Robin. It sounds like something you'd only see in a suspense thriller. Hackers able to wirelessly tinker with people's pacemakers, sending a fatal electric shock to the life-saving devices. And just to be clear, there are no indications that Barnaby Jack, the man who discovered this flaw, had a pacemaker, but some find his unexpected death rather mysterious.
His pacemaker can be wirelessly accessed with that number.
It was the shocking plot twist on the hit show Homeland. The answer is yes. Professional hacker Barnaby Jack was set to reveal the secrets of just how it can be done this past weekend until he mysteriously turned up dead. Just days before the 35-year-old was to speak on hacking humans at a major Las Vegas hacking convention.
He was able to remotely exploit them, and this talk was really dedicated to how the manufacturers could improve the security of the devices.
His girlfriend discovered his body in his San Francisco home on July 25th. Now the coroner's office is trying to determine just how Jack died. This morning, questions, even conspiracy theories, are swirling all around the untimely death of the so-called ethical hacker who once wowed audiences with his demonstration of ATM hacking. Jack dedicated his career to using his skills to expose vulnerabilities hackers can attack, helping manufacturers develop tighter safety measures.
He wanted to know, how could that stuff down there fail? And especially, how could it fail if there were some not nice people out there trying to make it crash?
As for Jack's warning about hackable implants, the FDA says there is no cause for alarm for the nearly
No cause for alarm.
James, and all of this is really just a TV show. It was on Homeland, and this is just all crazy talk, and we'll never see the demonstration because Barnaby Jack, and I think maybe whatever he was working on, is gone now. I guess that's a plot from a TV script, but he was very confident he could do it. Now you're hearing the after reports on all the news stations. This is ha ha ha. It's just the TV show Homeland. It's a crazy conspiracy theory. Yes, the guy did die unexpectedly, but don't worry. This can't even be done. It's just TV.
I think the only way this could be more blatant is if he had actually died of a failure of his pacemaker on the way to the event. I mean, they can't get much more blatant than this. And the idea that this is now being dismissed because he died on the way to the event is, I mean, again, it would be laughable if it wasn't so serious. But allow me to just pan back for a minute to look at the bigger picture of what all of this indicates. Because as we're seeing with the ability to hack everything, hack cars, hack pacemakers, hack ATMs, the ability for the NSA and the other Alphabet soup intelligence agencies to listen in on everything and to spy and tap and surveil and track and database everything. I mean, how can anyone seriously propose the types of transhumanist garbage that unfortunately is gaining steam among acolytes of the transhumanist pushers out there to brain chip everyone? Eventually we'll have this, all of this implanted directly in our bodies, and it'll be a wonderful nirvana because we'll all be jacked directly into the matrix. I mean, the internet, and we'll all be communicating with each other. Oh, it will be so wondrous. And every single time one of these stories comes out, it's another nail in the coffin of that dream, which is really more of a nightmare to myself, that that humanity is just going to merge with the machines. Because again, the point is always that there is always backdoors, there are always ways to hack into these systems, and the idea that we would entrust our lives, our sanity, our bodies to these types of systems that can be hacked into is, I think, the very worrying part of all of this. So I hope this is starting to seep into the consciousness of the public that this kind of sci-fi, you know, fantasy is not sci-fi at all. Yeah. It's more and more becoming part of our everyday reality. And if we don't understand the dangers of this, then people will start, will be programmed to accept the brain chips once they're here.
Well, and cybernetics has been big for years, man-machine interface to help people to walk that may have been crippled, or to help people with various disabilities, as we've seen diabetics use something as a computerized pump, and then we see the pacemakers. This man-machine interface stuff developed at DARPA, who we know loves us. If you don't know who DARPA is, they're the research development arm of the United States military. Let's call it the global military. And I know they just have our best interest at heart here, right? I mean, that's all this is about. But when you think about people walking around literally as human Borg, being able to be controlled like marionettes, are we really that far off?
Well, just keeping this in perspective, we should remember that the leader, the developer, the head of the Total Information Awareness Office, which was scrapped once it became public and people started to realize how horrific that actually was back in the Bush administration, the convicted Iran-Contra criminal, Admiral Poindexter, had once talked about how wonderful it will be when eventually the U.S. government and its alphabet soup agencies are able to literally nano-engineer every speck of dust on the planet. And he was speaking quite with a straight face when he said that. So again, it's an agenda that we can't even, at our level of understanding, our scheme in the big pyramid is difficult to even comprehend. The big boys with the big toys have very, very big plans. And unless we at least acknowledge that, I think we're going to stumble into them quite blindly. And that's the worst part about all of this, is that people seem only too happy to sign away their privacy, their freedom, their very lives to this technology, and to actually pay the companies for the privilege of doing so.
Your reality is already half video hallucination. If you're not careful, it will become total hallucination. You'll have to learn to live in a very strange new world. The battle for the mind of North America will be fought in the video arena. The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. Therefore, the television screen is part of the physical structure of the brain. Therefore, whatever appears on the television screen emerges as raw experience for those who watch it. Therefore, television is reality. and reality is less than television.
You're listening to the Jack Blood Show. Be bold, and my forces will come to your aid.
Case is closed.
James Corbett with us at CorbettReport.com. Corbett Report is
a podcast
at TheCorbettReport.com. It is generally free to the public, but donations are necessary to keep it going. As we tell you, vote with your dollars. And I want to really make an appeal for my friend James Corbett, because yesterday he helped us out a little bit on his show. James, I'm proud to say your listeners came through for us, and I want our listeners to do the same for you. So please tell people how they can support your show, because you don't have commercials, you don't do a lot of begging for money. You just expect people to honor the work that you've done and to vote with their dollars and support the things that are good for them. No doubt about it that your show is extremely good for the information stream. How do people support the show?
Well, on that note, I just received an email the other day from someone who was looking to advertise on my website, and in fact was offering a sum of money that I guess is not huge in the big scheme of things, but to someone like myself was a staggering amount of money.
No,
I will not. And I never will. And I don't have any plans to ever take advertising on the Corbett Report. So I'm going to do it the hard way. And so if people want to support me on that, the best way to do that, I have a subscription. It's a monthly fee as low as 100 Japanese yen a month, which is about $1 a month. And that gets you my weekly newsletter, which includes that international forecaster editorial we were talking about before, as well as recommended reading and viewing, discounts on my DVDs. And once a month, I have a subscriber-only video. So the best way to support me is to subscribe. That way it's win-win. You get something out of the deal, and I get to continue doing this. And so I'm blessed to say that enough people have done that, that I am actually able to make a living off of the website, which is more than I could have ever imagined. So I'm absolutely blessed with an incredible listenership. So so once again, subscriptions is the best way to do it. But for Jack Blood listeners out there, I think the most important thing is to support Jack. And then if there's anything left over, perhaps you can think about sending it my way.
Wow, well done, as we just said. Thank you very much, and for all of your help. But please, I want my listeners to support the things that are working and working out there for them. James, I love what you do, man, because you're not coming from a Democrat or Republican angle. I don't hear any propaganda when I listen to your show. I don't hear any hidden agendas coming from somewhere. I think that you're very good at sifting through those and eliminating them from your podcast. So you're just getting straight information. And James is a very trustworthy source. And I don't say that about too many people, man. So we got to keep you going, keep you thriving, keeping you around. You also had a new addition to the family, which I know you don't mind telling the world. And we congratulated you last time, more so that you're in Japan and you had a healthy baby, which I'm really glad to hear. And it's just such a joy when we have our children in the world, and what we want and love and do in the world takes a backseat to the future of these children. So you've got a nice, healthy heir to the throne there, James. But it's got to worry you being in the backyard of Fukushima. There's been a lot of developments on that. A couple of the major news stories are Japan to issue gravest Fukushima nuclear warning in 2 years. Fukushima Bay radiation levels highest since the measurements began. Tank leaks 300 tons of highly radioactive water at Fukushima plant, and Fukushima operator says workers dusted with radioactive particles. These are just some of the headlines in the mainstream media, and that doesn't get to what's really happening. James, what is really happening?
Well, that's unfortunately a pretty good summary. And just for some more background on that story about raising the severity level of the Fukushima leak, basically there's an international nuclear event scale that's used for these types of incidents, and they're going to move that up, the Fukushima leak, up to 3. This is a scale that goes to 7, but the fact that they're now moving this up once again 2.5 years after the fact shows that, in fact, something major is happening there. And that major thing is a major new leak that has been discovered and now admitted that, just to put in perspective the size of this leak, not only is it 300 tons a day that's leaking out into the ocean, but the amount of radioactivity in this water is just staggering. Normal levels of the radioactive water that's been processed at the plant is measured in a unit called becquerels per liter, so 150 becquerels of radiation per liter of water. The newly released leak is 80 million becquerels of radiation per liter, so a factor of, well, do the math,
I can't do the math. I want to say 5 million times more, but I don't think that's right. But anyway, significantly more radioactive. So this is a huge development. And now we have even China is coming out diplomatically saying they hope that Japan is taking this seriously and that they can get things under control. That's an interesting development when you have one of Japan's main geopolitical and military rivals starting to chastise Japan for its lack of movement on this. And of course, now we have the Japanese government finally admitting that maybe TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, isn't prepared to handle this on their own. Gee, you think? 2.5 years later, yeah. Now we have 80 million becquerel per liter water leaking out directly into the Pacific to the tune of 300 tons a day. Do you think they don't have this covered over? Maybe. So this is getting extremely serious. And unfortunately, the latest information just coming out in the last 24 hours or so, an investigative committee has found in Fukushima Prefecture, another 18 children have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer. So again, we're starting to see what could be the effects of this radiation already. And that's got to be worrying for everyone in that area.
I try not to fearmonger over information like this because, you know, people really take it and run with it and they say some pretty scary things. And a lot of people, you know, they get freaked out and they ruin their lives. You know, I've seen people shut their businesses down and head for the hills, and maybe that's appropriate, maybe it isn't, but I want to be really careful before I put that kind of information out. The fact of the matter is, we've got nuclear plants and leaking, we've got depleted uranium all over the place, there is nuclear waste and nuclear leaking, I mean, just all over for decades and decades. So how dangerous is the leaks at Fukushima, which, by the way, if you read Greg Palast's work, I mean, this could have been prevented minimally. You can take that conspiracy to the bank. Whether or not this was an engineered inside job and all the rest of it, I'll leave that to some of the listeners out there. So we know that they were cutting corners. That's why these things melted down. That's why the cores were exposed, and that's why we got the giant mess. But how dangerous is it? It's going to get in the food. It's going to be everywhere. Humans are highly adaptable. This has been going on for a long time. So what is the real risk on a scale of 1 to 10, say, just over the next year or two?
I'm not sure I could quantify it in that way, but there's a couple of different factors we have to look at. One is the fact that the cores, they still don't know, and they don't even have the technology to know where the cores are right now. And they believe that they've been contained, but there's the possibility that they've melted through and is now seeping into the groundwater itself. So that's a huge, huge part of all of this, the big question of where the cores are and how safely they're contained and whether they will continue to remain contained. That's a huge part of all of this. Another factor in all of this is, of course, the cover-up that's been ongoing since day one, and the government's refusal to even report on the basic information. For example, the fact that three of the reactors had completely melted down within 48 hours of the initial incident. That's a pretty major piece of information that they kept under wraps for upwards of a month and a half. So we know that they've been covering up and holding back information since the beginning. So we can't really trust anything that they're telling us about what's going on there. The fact that they're now raising the safety level indicator is a huge flashing red warning light, because if they're telling us this, then that must mean it's probably even worse than what they're saying. Again, I don't want to fearmonger about this, because I do know people have a tendency to go overboard with this. And I want to stress that, I mean, when it comes to, for example, atmospheric radiation, if you look at the SafeCast maps, for example, which are distributed maps that are created by individuals with their own readers, their own devices that are reading the atmospheric radiation, the levels in most of Japan are in fact lower than in many parts of the United States, just because of differences in background radiation, differences in radiation that comes from nuclear testing and the like, and Nevada and areas like that. So we shouldn't overemphasize what this radiation fear really is, but the fact that it's leaking directly into the ocean, I think, is an extremely worrying part of all of this, especially because they're still fishing off of the coast of Fukushima. They are still putting that fish directly into the food supply here in Japan. So that's why my wife and I have been avoiding seafood, and will do so unless we know exactly where it's coming from on the other side of the world. And even then, how do you know? I mean, it could be mislabeled quite easily. So so it's the big question.
Well,
mark.
Yeah, but you can even go fish in, you know, mid-America in a river somewhere, and because of rainfall and because of the constant flow of water, whatever, I mean, it could get in your food. So, look, and that's what I was thinking, is if it's really, this is really a big state of emergency, I doubt you're going to stay there with your wife and your son, right? I mean, so let's, you know, keep cool heads here. But at the same time, we have to ask ourselves, how stupid are we to build reactors right on the ocean where there are earthquakes and tsunamis? Number one.
And,
number two,
and
why
the
don't
design,
we? Yeah.
Can I just cut in there?
No,
the
that's what I was going to say.
The reactor is a huge part of all of this. And unfortunately, the exact same design exists in the United States. In fact, there's upwards of, I believe, 26, I'll have to double check my number on that, of the exact same design in the United States right now. Part of what makes it so precarious is that in reactor 4 at Fukushima, they had the spent fuel pool directly over the reactor, and it was damaged in the earthquake. As people might know, the reactor 4 building has been listing, and the possibility of a collapse has been there for some time, and the amount of radiation that would be released if the spent fuel pool collapsed is almost unthinkable. It would be many, many, many times a Chernobyl event if that happened. So what they're doing right now is they're preparing. They've got all the rigging in place, and they've done some testing of how they're going to remove the spent fuel from that pool, and they're going to start doing that operation later this year. That's going to be a very delicate operation, and one that could go wrong, and if it does, that could be an even bigger calamity than what we initially saw. So that's the thing that I'm going to be keeping my eye on very closely for myself and my family.
But if it's not on the news, it just didn't happen, as we all know here in the United States. I actually posted a story. I caught a little shit for it. All 107 U.S. nuclear reactors vulnerable to terrorists. And I wrote one word summary to this, and it's an oxymoron, because whether or not the terrorists blow up a nuclear reactor, or which they could have done on 9/11 allegedly, not too far away from the World Trade Center, so I don't know if the powers that be wanted to clean up that giant mess, but whether that happens or they just fail on their own because they are so shoddily run and they cut so many corners here, because if they don't cut the corners, James, it's not an affordable, it's certainly not a green technology when you think of all the carbon that has to go into, I hate to use these terms, go into building one of these reactors and to manage and deliver the fuel. It's really not even that cost effective per se, but they cut a lot of corners, and we're sitting here, it's a very dangerous thing to know that there's 107 of these dirty bombs just sitting and littered around the country. So it is something we need to be on it. Why aren't Americans, is it above their understanding how the things work, or they just have to trust the guys in the white coats and the suits and ties because it's too complex for their brains? I mean, why don't we care about it as much as we did in, say, the 70s?
The 70s, exactly right, because that's when some of the engineers that were involved in the construction of these Mark IV reactors, which is the kind at Fukushima, which has also scattered across the United States, you had some of the engineers actually resign their positions because they were talking about some of the design failures of these Mark IV reactors. So over the years, GE had to release certain recommendations for how to fix some of these problems that were implemented in different ways by different reactor operators, and unfortunately some of those recommendations were not taken into account at Fukushima. I in fact have a report about this on my website called Mark to Market, so people can search that on CorbettReport.com to find out more about these reactors and their design. But you're exactly right. I mean, not only these Mark IV reactors, but all the reactors scattered across the United States. I mean, it's just one major cataclysm away from a Fukushima-type situation. And the irony was that in 2011, in the summer, just a few months after Fukushima, we had all of those problems that were coming to light at American reactors, and we almost had a few situations with some fires and with some floods that could very well have been a Fukushima-type situation. So it's something that I hope that Americans and people around the world in various countries that have these types of reactors are at least keeping their eye on.
This is just in, as we're putting together our podcast. It'll be old news by the time we actually publish it, but get your opinion. 35 years for Bradley Manning. What do you think?
Well, what better indictment of the U.S. justice system is possible than that the person who, at very least, tries to blow the whistle, I mean, to make of it what you will with WikiLeaks and all of that, but here's someone who genuinely seems to be trying to blow the whistle on what he thought were war crimes getting sent to jail, whereas the people who actually committed those war crimes are free men. So it's just a travesty of justice. I think that the entire Bradley Manning incident from start to finish has been a complete farce. And the only one that's really indicted here is the American justice system.
Let's end on this. James Corbett, kind enough to be with us once a month here at the Jack Blood podcast, Jack Blood Show podcast, deadlinelive.info, corbettreport.com. Please tell people about James Corbett. His work, I think, translates to a lot of different people. So it will cross over to just general news people or to conspiracy people or what have you. So it relates to a lot of different people, and I find James to be extremely credible. I guess you've been wrong once or twice before in your life, James, but your track record compared to the mainstream media is just tremendous, and we look to your opinions for a lot of the things going on in the world. One of those things I want to talk about now is some breaking news, I guess, related to Syria. Opposition says as many as 1,300 killed in a gas attack near Damascus. Here we go again with the false flag gas attack, as if I don't think Assad would be that stupid. He's actually winning this so-called civil war and revolution over there. We've been talking about it for the last year. It doesn't seem like the powers that be, the global food chain, the global military-industrial complex, wants to go in there that much. It's not very popular, but now here's a pretty good excuse. You've got a few developments of your own related to Syria. Is this it? Are we going?
This is it. This is what I think is going to be the big one. If they're going to make a move on Syria, it's going to be as a result of an incident exactly like this. And unfortunately, this is the one we've been waiting for. Let's just put this in perspective for people who don't know about the history of this chemical false flag idea. Back in August of last year, we had some reports that came out from a Syrian news channel that a Saudi company had fitted 1,400 ambulance vehicles with anti-gas and anti-chemical filtering systems at a cost of $97,000 each. I wonder where they're getting that money. That were going to be used in the event of an attack that was going to be blamed on Bashar al-Assad. They were going to say it was a chemical weapons attack. They were going to bring in the ambulances that also were meant to be transporting military fighters, and they were going to start the last stand against Bashar al-Assad. That all came out in August of last year. In December of last year, there was a video released with some of the Syrian rebels going under the name the Almighty Wind Brigade. Make of that what you will. Showing them in graphic detail killing a rabbit with a chemical in a beaker, which they insert into a chamber in which this rabbit's being kept. It dies a slow, horrible death, which you can watch on YouTube. And then the person comes out and says, you saw what happened. This will be your fate, you infidel Alawites. I swear by Allah to make you die like these rabbits, 1 minute only after you inhale the gas. So those are the Syrian rebels who we are now asked to believe are the victims of the chemical weapons attack using chemical weapons on record in December. Later in December, in Aleppo, one of the main Syrian jihadist strongholds, the jihadist al-Nusra Front, which is linked has been linked to the mythical Al-Qaeda beast, overran a chemical factory, specifically a chlorine factory in the Aleppo area. And lo and behold, in March, the next year, March 2013, there was a chemical weapons attack very near Aleppo, in a village just to the west of Aleppo, that was initially they were trying to blame it on the Syrian military under Assad. But as it turned out, in fact, it was the Syrian military who died in the attack. 26 people died, including Syrian military officers. And it turned out not to be a chemical weapons attack, but in fact, a chlorine agent attack. And where did that chlorine source from? Could it be the chlorine that was seized in the factory raid in December previously by the Al-Qaeda front? All signs point to yes. Later in the year, later that month, actually, you have reports coming out about that incident. And again, it all seems to source back to the rebels. And in fact, it was the Syrian military that died. In May of 2013, May of this year, you had the UN weapons inspectors coming out and with their commission of inquiry on Syria. And they found, quote, according to the testimonies we have gathered, the rebels have used chemical weapons, making use of sarin gas. So the UN officially came out and blamed the rebels for using chemical weapons in May of this year. And then Just 2 days ago, you have a UN chemical weapons expert team arrive in Damascus, in Syria, to start a fact-finding mission about the use of chemical weapons in the country. And now here we are, and as we're recording this, it's August 21st, so 2 days after they arrive, there's this chemical weapons attack. And now we're being asked, at first it was 200 dead, then they said 500, then they said 700, now they're saying 1,300. We'll see what that number finally fixates on. But the point of this is the UN chemical weapons inspectors arrive, and then 2 days later, literally 15 minutes from where they're staying, near the Damascus airport, there's a chemical weapons attack that we're now being asked to believe was committed by the Syrian military. So apparently, Assad waited for the UN chemical weapons inspectors to arrive in his country before using chemical weapons on the militants in an operation that can't be understood in any other way than a suicide mission, that was not only a suicide mission, but completely unnecessary, because, of course, the Syrian military has had the upper hand for the last several months in that conflict. So now he goes and creates the stupidest possible move that he could possibly do by gassing his own civilians while the UN is right there.
Right.
And now we have Britain and France calling for a UN Security Council to take immediate emergency action on the issue. So here we go. If they're going to make any sort of move on Syria, I think it's going to come from an incident exactly like this.
When it came down to the end of the day, they justified the attack on Iraq because Saddam Hussein gassed his own people, gassed the Kurds, which technically weren't his own people, and technically he didn't gas them, at least according to Stephen Pelletier, who was a CIA guy on the ground over there at the time. But it really worked. It was pretty potent, and it's just amazing to see the playbook just rolled right out again. You know, people are going to watch this on CNN. They're going to see, by the way, 1,300 people dead, they say. It's kind of little coded message there for those of you who look for those things and can see them, maybe a little calling card. But CNN will show the dead people, just like Oliver North told me when they wanted to get people to take the anthrax shots in the military. They would show them a grisly scene of somebody dying from anthrax, and they all lined up to take the shots, even though sometimes the shots even killed them. But people are going to see the twisted faces and the disgusting debris of humanity, and they're going to want something done, or minimally they're going to turn their head and cough and not pay attention when something is done. This is the red line. Now we'll see if Obama obeys. The first one apparently wasn't potent enough, so they've done it again, and they've left him at this point, I guess, no choice, not that he's making the decision, but that he'll to go along with it and to get out and start selling it like soap.
That's exactly right. It's an absolutely ridiculous story on its face. There is absolutely no reason that Bashar al-Assad would do this unless he was utterly, completely insane and suicidal. And unless we go along with that narrative, this stinks to high heaven. But it's going to be very interesting to see what facts they come out with and how they support this. But the UN Security Council looks like they're going to be holding some sort of emergency meeting on this. So we'll have to see what comes out of it.
Well, let me make a prediction. So they finally get Assad. They get all the gold that he's been sitting on. They take all the property and the wealth, and they put their own guy in charge, and they are more brutal than Assad ever was, and there'll be bodies littered in the streets and death squads running around, and CNN won't even mention it. How about that?
Sounds about right. Sounds exactly what happened in Libya. Wow, imagine that.
And in Egypt and whatnot. So much more to talk about, but James, I think we've taken up enough of your time today. You were super. You were fantastic. You were great. You paid off as usual. It's James Corbett, the Corbett Report. Anything you want to add before we let you go?
I think that's going to do it for now. Once again, I just hope people will support Jack. I've been listening to the podcast, and it's excellent work, so I'm happy to support it, and I hope people out there will do so with their with their dollars and help to make it possible. So good on you for doing this, and thanks for joining the podcasting community. I hope it's a pleasant experience for you.
Well, I'm back at it for the second time. Got huge numbers the last time, James. We just didn't get a lot of financial support, so I've got to develop things a little better like you do it. Hopefully I'll learn from how you've been successful. And I'll tell you one thing, my brother, I'll do the podcast if only you're listening to it. I will still do the podcast. Just to think that you're out there listening to my craziness it kind of makes me feel a little warm and fuzzy. Thanks, James Corbett. Appreciate you being with us. Be well, stay bold, and we'll talk to you next month.
Take care, Jack.